Session number 9362, wheel number 3.
Colonel Han, wheel 3. Were there any changes at all in the Gold Coast Regiment as a result of the threatening war in 1939 or 40?
No. All the reserves, when the war was declared, all the reserves were called up because we then expanded from 2 battalions to 3 battalions, and we also had to get mechanized transport. Because at one stage, had the Italians come into the war when the Germans first started in 39, it would have meant travelling right across Africa. And this, or the route had been wrecked by the then colonel of the regiment. But by virtue of the Italians not coming into the war, this allowed us, it gave us 9 months' grace actually, because we went round in June 40, to East Africa, when the Italians came into the war. And this 9 months' grace allowed us to train properly. The reservists came back in, and in order to get the mechanization going, this is when the coastal boys, the drivers, were then being enlisted into the army. And this allowed us to do all our training properly. And by the time we were due to leave West Africa, the complete grade, brigade were trained in all aspects of war. One particular instance, though, I noticed when, in my first introduction, when you thought about the savvy boy, I remember on one particular instance, on a Saturday afternoon, the company I was with, we were 6 miles out of Accra. We were ordered into Accra because some of the Gold Coast drivers had mutinied.
What about?
Well, this is a game, you see. They're like lawyers to themselves. And they, I suppose, thought that we were being hard done by somebody. And they just mutinied in the lines. And my company, we had to do a forced march at 12 o'clock in the afternoon, in the, you know, midday, into Accra, 6 miles, in order to keep these chaps under control. And our chaps.
How did you do this?
Well, you just fix bayonets and say, right, nobody moves, and just keep them in the lines. And this is how it all things. I know afterwards the ringleaders were court-martialed, but this was at the beginning of the war, so there was no trouble after that. And I think if you look at some of the photographs, you'll find some of the drivers there are equally as good as other people.
And you got on well with them, those you met?
Yes. That's where they're doing distilled water and all the bits and pieces in the photographs, you see.
So, in March 1940, you went with regiment to Kenya, into the Northern Fundia district.
Yes.
You made the journey in convoy?
By boat.
Oh, by boat?
By boat.
How was this done?
Done from Takoradi, Cape Town, Durban, Mombasa. Mombasa you went by train to Nairobi. Nairobi went by train then up to Nanyuki. And from Nanyuki, they did a march to Isiola.
How did the troops react to being on the boat, which must have been the first time for many of them?
Well, it's like everything else. You explain to the African exactly what's going on, and he just goes, eh? And after all, don't forget, these chaps, a lot of them have never seen an aeroplane, and they're suddenly put in an aeroplane.
How did they react to that?
Well, this is the same way. They just say, oh, he goes. This thing that go fly in the air. And providing the European, This is where their trust is, you see. If the European will do a thing, they will do it. They might look a bit apprehensively at it and think, well, I don't know, this thing going to really going to work. But no, this is what they will do. Some of them are seasick, you see. I mean, this is all part of life, isn't it?
What was the role of the regiment when you eventually reached Kenya? What were you doing for the next few months?
Well, when we got to East Africa, our role then, we were then sent up to the northern frontier district, a place called Wajir. And we relieved, because when the Italians came into the war, history will show, they took a place called Moali, which is on the frontier, and pushed the cow back to another place called Buna. And then our two West African brigades, that's the Nigeria Brigade and the Gold Coast Brigade, we were then sent up into the northern frontier district in order to relieve the KAR, and they all came back to retrain and do all the recruiting bits and pieces. Whilst we did 6 months then in the northern frontier district.
And what were conditions like there?
Our job then was patrolling. And don't forget, the Italians had what they call their local chaps, what they call the shifters. They were commanded by Italian officers and NCOs, and part of their job was doing what we were doing. We were patrolling the southern line of Abyssinia, and there were two or three skirmishes.
What happened?
Well, I lost a very great friend there. He'd only been up there 1 month, and they were ambushed on the way back. Because everywhere you go, you had to go in a lorry. The distances travelled, and then you've gone out the lorry, and then you patrol the frontier, just looking for these shifts and so forth. You see, and don't forget the local inhabitants too. They were shifter went round looking for these people because they stole cattle and did all sorts of things, you see, and so one had to sort of try and keep the peace going. And eventually, I think by the time we'd finished up there, we withdrew what in December 40 from the frontier. And by this time, I think the whole of the East African campaign was then set up, ready to go into Abyssinia. We had one battle whilst we were up there to El Wek. This was the first time the troops had been in action with the South African army.
How did this work? Were they well coordinated?
This worked very well. We had the South African Air Force came over and they did their runs to see with their fighters. But the battle lasted 3 days. It took 2 days in order to climb everybody in the vehicles and went up there. But no, I think you'll find that everybody acquitted themselves very well. It's the first time they'd been into action like that. This was the thing, you see. And there are occasions where the battalion went to Dif. This is another frontier station. And but this particular one, this is when this was all controlled by the divisional headquarters, the whole thing, and with the South African Army, the whole lot on the ground. This is the 16th of December, 1940.
And how did you find the Africans reacted under fire?
Based on the whole, I think you'll find that the odd chap probably blinked a bit, but normally, having had them on field firing, they knew the sound of everything. So, no, I think they were all right. And as I say, if they were ably led, they'd go anywhere. One particular incident, I think I must record it, was that later on in the war, one of our Africans got an MM. He was a tank man. We used to have boys anti-tanks in those days, 0.5. and he'd been put at the bend of a road because the Italians had little armoured cars, little two-man little armoured cars, and this particular, they were coming down the road, sweeping the guns, going backwards and forwards, and this African soldier was with his boy's gun right on the corner. And this thing got nearer and nearer and nearer, and eventually, when it was about 15 yards away, he just fired the gun. But he hit the driver dead central right in the forehead. And afterwards they said, "Why you no shoot before?" And he said, "But Massa, you go tell us for training, but you no shoot till you see the whites in them eyes." And this is perfectly true. I mean, this is the chap who had been taught something, and he really did it.
Did you ever come across a problem of what's been called bloodlust amongst Africans? Or were they very disciplined during the battle itself?
No. I can't remember any occasion when that actually happened. I can't think of any occasion, no. Because most of the Africans, as I say, they were under strict control in battle and so forth, and I think you'll find that with the European in charge, this couldn't happen, I'm sure.
In February 1941, after this patrolling exercise had finished, you joined the 3rd 6th KAR in Tanganyika. Now, why was this?
Well, this was on the expansion of the KAR. They were short of various jobs, I suppose, the European side, and on promotion, we were all in, with three of us sent from the Gold Coast Regiment to the KAR on promotion.
As a warrant officer?
As a warrant officer, yes, RQMS. And this was my introduction to the KAR.
What differences did you find between that and the Gold Coast Regiment?
Well, having served with the Gold Coast and trained them, I suddenly was pitched in with the King's African Rifles, and everybody was talking Swahili, and I didn't know a word.
Did you pick it up easily?
Oh yes, one gets the basic of it, but even then, in the KAR, this is wartime I'm talking about, that there were lots and lots of people who'd been to mission schools and so forth who spoke English, so you picked it up afterwards. We used to call it Bush Swahili, but you got by with the African soldier.
Did you find any differences in the KAR soldiers?
I did.
What sort of differences?
Because I think you'll find that whereas our chaps came from tribal areas, the KAR on the wall, they just gathered in people in order to, you know, for the expansion.
What sort of effect did this have then?
It probably took longer for training. Oh. This was the side of it. It probably took longer for training, but in the end, it all came out in the end, and they were quite good soldiers.
Were there any other differences, say, in standard of accommodation or food? Or
no, practically the same. An African, there's very little difference. They all live on posho and all the bits and pieces. I would say it's hardly any difference at all between the two from that side of life. Anyhow.
And what about your own accommodation? Again, much the same?
Oh yes, but we didn't stay long enough in Moshi. I mean, the next thing we were up in Abyssinia.
Yes.
After joining the KAR, a place called Moshi, this is the first time I'd seen the biggest mountain in Africa, Kilimanjaro. And we were at the base of this, but we did all our training at the Serengeti Plain. And then in June 1941, we then went to Mombasa and shipped ourselves to Berbera. This is the British Somaliland. And then we, from there, we then went up to Mandera. And from Mandera, we were then taken over. This is when we had to do the French, the Vichy French, were then in occupation in Djibouti. And one of the things we were destined to do was to stop fresh meat, this is the goats and sheep, from getting into Djibouti. And so we spent 3 months in British Somaliland with the troops around. And I think if you look at the photographs, you'll find that the most unpleasant place to be in, literally. It was after the Vichy French, it's when the Free French came into the war, and Djibouti was not occupied at all. This is captured by the French, so then we were all right. And then the next stage, we then had to make our way up Addis Ababa, and this entailed going all the way up to Dourado. There's one railway running in those days, Dourado up to, and then from Addis Ababa we all had to get onto transport. Now you can imagine then, everyone just lived on transport for the next 9 months on just an open lorry and so forth, and this was life. And then making our way from there, and by this time the Italians were going backwards up the road towards Gondar, and our job then was seeing the POWs coming down and making sure that the line of communication were open. And this is where we saw all the terrain that there is in Abyssinia. It really is terrific. You go up 11, 12,000 feet and then you go down again, and then you go up again and down again. And eventually we all got up to it's the last big battle, was at Gondar, and we were then at a place called Venticinque, which is about 50 miles from Gondar. And this is where the Italians made their last stand there and all around in the hills.
And you were involved in...
We were involved in this, in the battle, the last battle of all, in Gondar. And...
What was your exact role in this?
Our role there was to try and capture Venticinque and gradually move down, and the whole place was getting encircled. And before this all happened, before anything was shelled, there was quite a lot of air activity went on with the South African Air Force, and the Italians still had their CR-42s in those days. But eventually, before it all happened, and the ITOs just packed up. The Italians, they've been packed up, and this was the end of Gondar in December 41.
How were the Abyssinian tribes reacting to all this?
Well, the Abyssinians, this is rather interesting because he had come back onto the throne by then. He came back from England, you see, and was put back on the throne. But one of our jobs after this, we were then all sent... our brigade, we then had to look after the southern part of Abyssinia from Addis right down to Berber. And it's quite a stretch. And the battalion I was with, we had a 500-mile stretch to look after. This was the battalion from Jigjiga to Mandera, right down Hargeisa. And part of our job then was quelling the local tribes, because one must realise that when the Italians packed in their war, a lot of the local tribes, they got arms and ammunition. And if one looks back at the history of the Abyss, the local tribes don't look upon the king of Abyssinia as their chief. They had their own chiefs. This is the point, you see. So a lot of patrols had to be done, and We had companies here, there and everywhere in order to quell the local rebellions that were going on.
Were they actively hostile and attacking the British Army?
Oh, they would have done, oh yes. There was still what we still call shifter. They're the local bandits.
Not necessarily pro-Italian or something.
Oh, no, nothing at all. No, they were after themselves. Because wherever you went, you always had to have an escort. This is vital, and one of the things.
Do you think there had been much dislocation of the little local economies during the last, say, year before mm-hmm. Gondar? Or had people, the ordinary people in Abyssinia, been able to get along with their own lives, with herdsmen or tribes?
Well, I think you find that the locals, you see, the whole history of Abyssinia is that they're all tribal chiefs. And Haile Selassie only ruled in and around the capital. And in southern Abyssinia, there's quite a lot of unrest went on. But our other job, once we were there, was the evacuation of all Italians.
How was this
the
going?
Men, the women, and the children. And this was all done. The British government managed to get two boats into Berbera, Red Cross, and then one had to again escort all the, you imagine what how this is all done, because there's no railways. It all had to be done by road, so camps were staged all the way down, and the women and children all had to be evacuated right from Addis Ababa right down to Berbera and put them on the boats.
What happened to the men?
To
the Italian POWs?
The POWs were then all shipped down to Kenya. This is where they set up all the prisoner war camps. They were all in Kenya.
Italian morale, were they very despondent or just relieved?
They were not good fighters. No, I wouldn't say they were good fighters. No, because one or two of my friends who were railway people in West Africa, I met them working their way up from they're up to Addis Ababa. I mean, this is all another side of it, you see. And we also had people in the KAR who joined the army, and then as the army went through, they dropped off at various points and became district commissioners. And they did the civilian side of it. So it was very well planned, the whole way the war went, right the way through Abyssinia.
Were there any aspects of inefficiency that you can remember?
Apart from odd items of rations getting through, I don't think we were very well looked after. There's a very good airplane service between Nairobi and wherever one was for troops. The mail came through and things like that. No, I think this is during the rainy season, one lagged a bit behind time because, after all, your rations have to come 500 miles by road, and not first-class road. I mean, there's not metallic roads. This is the whole thing, you see. So, and then once we were there, we all had to have leave. And so this is a great upheaval, you know, sending the Africans on leave. And one had to go up to Addis Ababa to get the convoy, and then it was 1,500 miles by road to Nairobi.
Is this where everybody took their leave?
1,500 miles travelling by road. And you do about 100 miles a day, so you can imagine it's 15 to 18 days on the road, day after day. And so there we are.
What was the standard of the rations? Did it deteriorate during this time?
No, the rations were on, because you see, you bought your meat on the hoof. This was another side to it, you see. Wherever you were in Abyssinia, you could go and buy a cow or a sheep or things like that. So whatever you do, and I know it, I remember buying one or two sheep there, and this is where no notes were passed. It all had to be passed in silver, and then all the silver had to be banged onto a stone. So it was, there's so many coins were dubbed. And in order that the chap who was selling you a sheep or a cow, whatever it was, then he had to have the money.
Where did this money come from?
Well, this
what
was
coinage were you using?
The money, you see, the system we had, you had paymasters. And this is how your money came in. They carried loads and loads of money with them. Sacks of it, you know, in order to pay the Africans as well. So one had to, you escort yourself, banks were opened up, paymasters were in Hara or wherever it was, you see, and this is how you went up there and you drew your money.
What was the currency you were using?
Now, this is very interesting. Currency in those days, there was the Italian lira, which went afterwards, but you see, then they brought in the Maria III, the dollar. Mm-hmm. There was also the rupee, because a lot of people went over to Aden, and so they took over, and the currency in Aden was the Indian rupee. And then there was the East African shilling, which was another currency, and don't forget there's also the French franc in Djibouti. So wherever these chaps came from, they used to ask for different currencies, you see, so one had to pay them, if you could anyhow, or take them up to the paymaster and get payment that way. This is how one used to try and get out of it.
Were all these forms of currency legal tender in Nairobi?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes. The banks used to take anything like that. Yeah. But no, the Maria III, the dollar, I've still got one or two left here, which I brought back during the war.
But what did the troops do when they were on leave in Nairobi? Completely the new town?
Well, again, you see, with the troops, most of the regiment I was with, they all came from Tanganyika. So they then, when they arrived at Nairobi, they then had to get a train to go up to Kisumu, down Lake Victoria, to the bottom of Lake Victoria, Mwanza. And then they, from there, you got on a road convoy. Or they probably went down to Dar es Salaam. So wherever they went, then they report to commissioner. But this is one of, it's a great feat when you look at it, in sending chaps all over Africa on leave.
Was there ever any trouble?
Oh, not a lot of trouble. I mean, you've got the odd chap who didn't come back probably or something like that. But
not many?
No. No, we got them all back again because eventually we then, after the evacuation of all the Italians, we then came back into Abyssinia at the end of 1942.